The Guardian.
As a Football Weekly listener, you'll know there's nothing like being at the big match. So why not check out the thousands of tickets on offer at Guardian Tickets? You'll find tickets for the very best football fixtures across the top leagues in Europe, including Borussia Dortmund v Schalke on October the 20th and Juve's clash with Inter on November the 3rd. To find out more, head to guardiantickets.co.uk/footballweekly.
Football Weekly with James Richardson.
It was a weekend of epic battles. Barcelona v Real, OM v PSG, Milan v Inter, Bale Suarez v Forces of Gravity. And it's an epic Football Weekly, as from Camp Nou to St Lone Sharks Park, we round up all the big performances, including Legends of the Fall, Gareth and Luis, who stood up almost as well as JT's statement to the FA. There's Sid in Spain as Madrid go top, Atletico Madrid that is, post, and who's back here was better, Ibra's or Jackson Martinez? All of that and more in today's Football Weekly. Yes, listeners, yes, and more. And I say more, there's loads of Premier League stuff like Man United and that, in the company of John Ashton today. Hi, John.
Hello.
Seems like ages that we've had you, me, here, podding.
Yeah, it's been a while.
Been a while. Too long, John. Too long.
Yeah. I've been plugging away in the reserves, you know, giving it 110% of training. I'm just, you know, hope to get the call from the gaffer.
Well, you have to take your chances, don't you?
Absolutely, yeah.
You do. Hey, here's Owen Gibson.
Hello there.
Hi, Owen. You scrub up nicely for a man who's had Rice Krispies tipped quite literally on your head.
This is true by my three-year-old son.
Three-year-old son called?
He's an angry man, Thomas.
Philippe Auclair.
Hello.
Hi, Filippo. You're all over the TV these days. Big time.
All over, right. Yeah. Slight exaggeration.
Great to have you on board, because there's a lot to talk about. It certainly is. Hey, should we start with St James's Park? Man United at Arsenal, everyone's saying this is Man United of old back.
Well, it was for the first 15, 20 minutes. Newcastle just didn't seem to turn up, didn't seem to switch on, and United dominated possession for the first 15. I think it was something like 90% of possession they'd had after about 11 minutes, which, you know, it's a short period of time, but I mean, that's an astonishing domination of the ball. United scored from two corners, two headers, which I guess will infuriate Alan Pardew, because if you're going to get beaten by United, you might as well get beaten properly. If they score two wonder goals, then fine. If you're losing from corners, it's going to be quite irritating.
Third goal, to be fair, was a bit of a goal.
If he meant it.
Well, even if he didn't, it was still pretty special, wasn't it?
Well, can something be special if you didn't mean it? I don't know.
That does bring us into a whole debate about the nature of volition and to what extent we are agents of our own destiny. And
free
or
will.
What?
Is there such a thing as free will?
I don't know, Philippe. That's coming up in part three.
But they did make it easy for them, though, didn't they? You're right.
You Newcastle.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, also, their injury list didn't help them much, did it? But Man United, well, I was interested to see Evans' opening score, ever got the second, both of whom were supposed to be finished some time ago at United, but playing a valuable role in this occasion.
Yeah, absolutely. Evans still strikes me as one of those players that'll end up like a Wes Brown or a John O'Shea and eventually will drift away from those top echelons of the game.
Sunderland, do you think?
Well, maybe Sunderland or somewhere of that ilk. Mm. And every year had his best game of the season, I think, and perhaps even his best game of 2012.
Not necessarily saying much.
No, exactly. But I think Tom Cleverley made such a difference in midfield, just having somebody in there that can balance that side up and allow the attacking bits to do their attacking
and
stuff.
He started with three forwards as well, and Rooney looked on his game, didn't he?
Right. Because that was the thing.
Rooney in a new role. Again.
Sorry? In a new role?
How many times is it that we've talked about Rooney's new role? Because he played in midfield, basically. Right. Which he enjoyed very much, apparently.
I'm glad you mentioned midfield, because there's been a lot of United bashing on the fact that they didn't have a proper midfield, and Newcastle do have such a great pair of central midfielders and all that. Mm-hmm. And so it was quite counter-logical that United did kind of run things in midfield.
But it's quite interesting that Rooney was dropping deep, and often when he plays up front on his own, he ends up dropping deep, and he gets getting frustrated. But because he had those two other supporting players, it seemed to work, and he seemed to enjoy it.
Yeah. Right. John Dykes here tweeting, Chiote ugly, like the film Coyote. Ugly at Newcastle. He said, but he rather more special, this one. He says, the Canaries went down without as much as a tweet against Chelsea, because, you know, they actually called the thing. Yeah, I like that. Wow. How about that Chelsea performance, eh? Featuring the bad boys of West London.
Putting aside all the off-the-pitch stuff, I mean, on the pitch, they were great, weren't they? You know, kind of. Again, you could say it was easy against the Norwich team that made it very easy for them defensively, but those having those you know, all those attacking midfielders buzzing around. It's great to watch. You know.
It was absolutely lovely. I mean, I was at Stamford Bridge on Saturday,
right.
And yes, the way it's really starting to happen. What Di Matteo obviously wants, which is this constant switching between Hazard, Mata, and Oscar. All three of whom had a superb game, including Oscar, despite the fact he wasn't very spectacular. Obviously, he's tactically extremely astute. And the only slight problem that it causes from time to time for them is the fact that they're switching so much that if they lose the ball, it's very difficult to know who is supposed to track back.
Oh, right.
And which is how we saw the Norwich's opening goal, which was very well taken by Grant Holt, by the way. But when they start clicking, which they did on Saturday, it was absolutely beautiful to watch.
Right, clicking, of course, from Ashley Cole. He said, steering majestically the conversation back to the non-fluffy stuff. Philippe, you came in and said, let's talk about fluffy
stuff.
Yeah,
I only want to talk about fluffy stuff. And I've got some fluffy stuff for you, because I was wondering, I saw all these Norwich supporters who had travelled to the ground, I was wondering, what is a collective noun for canaries?
Oh, right.
You know, you've got collective nouns in England, in English, for every kind of bird. And do you know how you call a flock of Norwich supporters?
Do you know?
I found out, yes.
Oh.
It's an opera of canaries. Isn't that sweet?
Really?
Yeah.
As in...
Yeah. An opera of canaries.
Yeah.
Anyway.
That's interesting, isn't it?
It's very fluffy.
Right. Canaries. That is very fluffy. I tell you what, Owen, you're quite happy not to talk about Ashley Cole, because you had that all through your weekend, didn't you?
I'll talk about the non-fluffy stuff, don't worry. I mean, you know, I think he will be charged by the FA today. I think they'll fine him over the tweet. Chelsea will fine him over the tweet. But whether that gets to the nub of the matter is another conversation entirely. I mean, I think it depends what Chelsea now do to punish John Terry, Ashley Cole, and their club secretary, David Barnard. Because, you know, clearly, if we take the FA report, and it is a fairly well-argued report, over 63 pages, they clearly insinuate that Terry, Cole and Barnard concocted a story, effectively. I mean, that's effectively what they're accusing them of, to explain Terry's on-the-pitch exclamations.
Presumably, from Chelsea's point of view, they'd like to see this whole thing finally ended one way or another, which is what it shows no signs of happening.
Well, I think, the FA, Chelsea, all hope that Friday would draw a line under it, and Ashley Cole very quickly put paid to that within minutes of the report landing. But, you know, we can't draw a line under it until you know, it's been decided what punishment should be meted out. And yes, John Terry has, you know, willingly retired from international football, but Chelsea are his employer, and, you know, they've now got to decide what they do and where they go next, and that won't be easy for them.
Right. What do you think their options are, realistically?
Well, I think, you know, do they strip him of the captaincy? Do they ban him? I mean, the more strident voices would say, you know, he should be thrown out of the club altogether. How can you have a club that, you know, professes to have a zero tolerance policy on racism and yet have this man as your captain, leader and legend? I think that's basically the options that are open to them. But it won't be easy, because the sort of cult of John Terry runs so deep through that club.
To the point that during the game, I think there were three bursts of a chant which was John Terry, Ashley Cole, John Terry, Ashley Cole, and which was not a small smattering of supporters in Matthew Harding's stand. It was literally all of the home supporters.
No, the mentality is majority strong among football fans, isn't it? You know, and kind of, you know, you sort of knew as soon as that report landed in the email on Friday that they'd get a huge reception from the Chelsea fans on the Saturday. And I think that's not a uniform view among all Chelsea fans, but, you know, certainly, as you say, if we're to mark it by the loudness of the response, they certainly got a good...
On the other hand, I think I was quite struck at the press conference after the game that the way that Roberto Di Matteo, who is not a man who gives much away in his press conferences, to say the least, seemed rather set and rather stern, actually, when he talked about it, and we talked about disciplinary action being taken against the players, obviously, or the player. And it seems that they want to tackle that. The club would love to tackle that.
But the Ashley Cole thing, while you know, serious, I suppose, in terms of kind of disrespect, using Twitter to disrespect the FA, it's a side issue, really, compared to the much more serious matter of the racist incident.
Well, yeah, it is and it isn't, just because one of the things about this is you can view what happened in various different ways, whether it was the heat of the moment, etc. But one of the, I think, upsetting things, and one of the reasons that I think people push for a sterner punishment, is the fact there's never been an apology or any admission of any blame. And while Ashley Cole continues to just say that the FA are a bunch of whatevers, then it just seems to be a complete denial from everyone at Chelsea. And that's one reason, I think, why a lot of people would like to say, no, you have to stand up. Terry has to stand up and say, yeah, I really made a huge mistake.
Yeah, no, absolutely right. And, the, you know, kind of the siege mentality at that club as well. I think it was striking for me that Chelsea seemed to get quite a lot of praise from within football about the way they've handled this compared to Liverpool and the whole Suarez, which obviously, you know, was handled publicly very badly. But behind closed doors, it seems to me that Chelsea have handled this just as badly. And, you know, people now want to see them answer for that.
Isn't part of the problem now that if Terry does apologise for the initial incident, he then admits to covering up for
it? It undermines his entire defence for a whole year, you know, which has been found to be contrived and implausible by an FA panel.
Golly, eh? What a mess they've got themselves in. Anyway, all very unpleasant. Now, in the meantime, Chelsea remain 4 points clear on top of the table. We're going to take a quick musical sting and then we're going to go all European on you before returning to the Premier League later on, listeners, later on. Right, part two begins with, in prospect, a lot of top continental coverage. But first off, collective nouns, excitingly enough. Opera for...
Of Canaries.
Of Canaries. Well, you see, producer Ben went away and he came up with some other ones. Hey, apparently this is true. Crash of rhinos. Crash of rhinos. Yeah? Never heard that one before. A rout of snails. I'm not sure about that one.
That sounds made up.
I can't imagine snails routing anything.
They no, you can't, slowly. Can you? No. A rout of snails. What's this? An army of frogs?
Well, probably beating a hasty retreat.
I see what you're doing there. I see what you're doing there. Hey, Philippe, we've just... I don't know what the collective noun for a collection of European newspapers is, but that's what we've got on the table now, because you've got your L'Equipe, I've got my Gazetta. Yeah. John, you've got Bild there.
I've got Bild,
What has it got on it?
It's got a strong man. This is right up your street, Jimbo.
Very much so, yeah.
A strong man carrying... what can only be described as two live pigs.
Right, two live pigs.
Wow.
Impressive stuff. Although the pigs look very, very unhappy to be there.
Yeah.
Trussed up as they are.
All right. Could you turn to the football pages?
Oh, I suppose so, yeah.
Yeah, go on. In the meantime, Philippe, so it was a big week. What an extraordinary Sunday night it was. Has there ever been a Sunday night like it?
Not quite.
All right, because in France you had your Olympic Marseille PSG.
Absolutely.
And then elsewhere you had all sorts of other top things. Two huge games in Spain. We'll come on to them later. The Milan Derby in Milan. In Belgium, I believe, there was a...
Well, Standard Anderlecht, of course.
Thank you, absolutely.
There was Fenerbahçe-Beşiktaş as well
was
in Turkey.
There?
Yep.
Oh! And I'm missing one, aren't I? What's the other one? Oh, yes, Sporting Lisbon-Porto.
Which wasn't the worst.
It wasn't. It featured the goal of, 2012, I'm going
possibly.
With.
A candidate for.
Yeah, right.
Jackson.
Jackson Martinez. Tell us about Jackson Martinez's goal.
Jackson Martinez receives the ball.
Yes.
He's back to goal.
Ooh.
Ooh. He's jogging towards goal.
Backwards?
Backwards.
Right, yep.
Bounces the ball off his chest. And
no.
In one movement...
Yes.
...with his back heel, he backheels the ball into the net with the right foot. Absolutely magnificent. All in one movement.
Right.
Terrific.
It was amazing, wasn't it?
Mm.
Was it better than Ibra's goal?
I'm not too sure about that. I loved Ibra's goal.
All right. Ibra's goal was?
Ibra's goal was from a corner.
Yep.
He escapes the attentions of Benoît Kolou, had a very good game otherwise... And with the outside of his right heel, Jet propels the ball from actually quite a distance. Absolutely superb, technically speaking.
It was kind of side heel volley.
Oh, it's absolutely magnificent.
But absolutely,
yes.
No question, he meant it.
He did.
Yeah, Ibra means it.
He's Swedish.
All right, then. Well, go on, then tell us about PSG OM, because Marseille had taken the lead.
Yes, indeed. Paris came back from 1-0 down, 1-1. Zlatan made it 2-1.
About a minute later as well.
Yeah,
with a free kick.
It all happened. I mean, the first 30 minutes of that game were just a blur. It was absolutely superb, and I think one of the best half hours of football we've seen this season in Liga.
Right.
Petered down a little bit in the second half, I'm afraid. But still, one of the good plasticos of recent years. And
right.
With, fortunately, no trouble whatsoever. It was the first time that some PSG supporters had been allowed to go to the Velodrome since 2009, where there had been some fairly nasty incidents outside the ground. Only 123 made it, with, of course, quite a lot of security around it. But it's a step in the right direction. And apparently there will be 400 Marseille supporters going to the League Cup game, which is taking place at the end of the month, which hopefully this the start of things becoming a little bit more normal in that very, very strange... violence. I don't know. There's always been something violence around that fixture, which is crazy when you think that you're talking about a club, PSG, which only exists, has been existing since 1970, 71.
Mm. No.
And then you wouldn't think it's a historical or local rivalry, but Yeah. It is intense. And but it was a good game.
All right, it was a bit of a rapprochement happening.
I wouldn't
moment.
Go that far.
Right.
A beginning to the start of the beginning of a possible resolution.
Maybe a détente.
Sometime
would
to
it
come.
Be a détente?
Yes.
Right, well, anything else about France? Montpellier?
Montpellier had another wonderful weekend, losing at home 3-2 to Evian Thonon-Gaillard. It's not good.
Evian,
I mean, it's the confirmation.
Evian, that is.
It's another proof that the club simply doesn't have the squad to play both in the Champions League and in Ligue 1, and that the priority in the mind of the players must be the Champions League, where they've had some decent performances, the second half against Arsenal, certainly, the games against Schalke, where they also showed an awful lot, and they crumbled again. So that's really bad. They're 15th in the table, but they don't look. I mean, they won't be competing for a European place. You're looking at my L'Équipe because you're surprised by the front page because it's got nothing to do with football. You would have thought it might have to do something with football, but not at all.
One last for the road, it says.
Yeah.
What's that about?
Sebastian Loeb.
Oh, right.
Have you heard this thing called rallying?
Yeah.
Okay, well, he's won it again.
Right.
Yeah.
Of course, for the PSG ninth time. Rallied in their game against Toulouse. But that's not the sort of thing you're talking about, is it?
No.
Was there a football headline inside? Who was the winner then? I know it was a draw, but was one team a winner in the plastic?
No. Football the winner, Jesus.
Right.
They gave the game a 5 out of 6, 5 stars out of 6, which I think is a little bit optimistic, but or generous, rather. Ibra trop puissant, which is...
too powerful.
Yeah, but it's also a pun on trop puissant is used by supporters of OM.
Oh.
As well to describe their own team.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
Oh, that's lovely. Yeah. Good. Gazzetta La Sport has Samuel Fossa 10 because he's now played in 10 derbies and won all of them. This is Walter Samuel who headed home the only goal. As you know, John Ashdown, because to your cost, you were forced by the man to watch this. With all the other great football out there, you had to sit through Milan Inter with me.
Well, that was the highlight, was the half time and pre match. Banter on ESPN, obviously.
Yeah,
it was a fail. It was awful, really. I found it actually quite depressing by the end.
Right.
How far both teams, really, but particularly Milan had sort of fallen since the great days. Yeah. Inter scored very early on. Samuel getting on the end of a free kick. And then
looked like at that point there'd be a really kind of thrilling slew of goals from the Nerazzurri.
Well, then, seconds later, Diego Milito should have made it 2-0 when he was given the ball by Abbiati and delayed his first shot, then rushed the subsequent header. And then after that, it was just dire, particularly after the sending off of Nagatomo for a ridiculous handball.
Still, half time was good, though.
Yeah, half time. There was some good adverts for various, things. And the second half, Milan attacked. They had the ball.
Yeah, don't worry. We can move
just,
on.
They just slung it in. And when you look at the way that other top teams in Europe, other big clubs in Europe, are beginning to try and develop the way that they play, the style that they play. Milan's plan of giving it to Emanuelsson and him dinking it into the back post where Boateng was sort of hovering and swinging his boot, or Montolivo just pinging it from 40 yards because he was like sick of Bojan being absolutely useless up front and just shooting from 45 yards because he couldn't think of anything else to do. It
takes a lot to make you angry, John, but boy, you are angry. Wow, that's interesting. Milan remained down in 11th place. You may have seen at the end of that game, we showed the Napoli goals against Udinese, a very fine strike from Panda. Have you actually switched off by that? Wow, interesting. But that means that a very interesting position at the top of Serie A, because you've got Napoli off to their best start since the 87-88 season, back when Maradona walked the earth. And they're level with Juve, who have now gone 46 games.
Should have been Maradona walked on water.
Well, that's also true.
Mm.
Yeah, thanks for that. 46 games unbeaten in Serie A. And their manager, Antonio Conte, who was banned for 10 games, has had that reduced to 4. He feels he should have been absolved 100%. But it does mean that I think December the 9th, he'll now be able to retake his position on the bench. The only other thing I want to mention about Serie A, well, there's lots of other things I could mention. One other little thing, can I? Zeman team with a clean sheet. It happened this weekend. He dropped loads of big names, including De Rossi, and Roma won at home for the first time in ages.
I think that Zeman had a team, the average age was something like 21 years.
There were, I think, 5 players under the age of 21,
Which for an Italian team is almost unheard of.
Yeah, except that it is actually heard of a lot at the moment. If you look at the Milan side as well, there were a lot of young players out
there.
That's
why I was hinting at, is that a sea change, Jimbo?
Well, yeah, they're too broke to have kind of established players. It's largely the issue. But, you know, if it encourages them to bring in young players, the problem is that a lot of the young players that you'd like to see them bring in have now hightailed it to France. We're giving people like Verratti and, you know, there'll be others who do the same. Anyway, there you go. Now, that said, we mentioned Jackson Martinez in Portugal. We did the French bit, the Italian. Hey, Sid in Spain. He's up next. Sid?
Sid? Hello, James.
Is that you?
Yes, it's me. How are you?
Are you there? Yeah, I'm very well, actually. Thanks. You're coming through loud and pretty clear, I have to say, today. What's up?
Well, I don't know. I'm sitting in a I don't know what you call these things, kind of a work centre in a hotel trying to finish writing something.
Right.
Well, I had a brilliant, brilliant moment at the hotel yesterday.
Ooh, go on.
I turned up. I go to reception and the woman says to me, right, so Mr. Lowe, blah, 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 tapping the details in and stuff. And she looks at me and says, how many of you are there? And I was thinking, have I got an imaginary friend that I'm not aware of? I said, one. She said, one, not two. I said, yes, just one. She said, okay. And she carries on tapping it in and she says, you do know that when you book this room, you booked the Paquete Romantico, don't you?
Sid.
And I said, no. And she said, oh, well, hang on, I'll just see if I can sort it out. And
right.
Then she got on the phone, and then she came off the phone and she said...
Who did she find?
Well, she said, look, I'm really sorry, your room's been set up for the Paquete Romantico.
Wow.
And I said, what does that mean? She said, well, there's petals on the bed and a bottle of, bottle of champagne for you.
No way, Sid.
And I said, oh, it's all right, leave it there, don't worry about it. And so it was indeed true. There was petals in a huge heart shape on my bed. And the terrible thing is, honestly, if you're bringing someone to a romantic weekend in this hotel, there's something seriously wrong with you.
What hotel was it, Sid?
I couldn't possibly say that. I'd be very, very unfair. It's the one I always stay in Barcelona as well. That's the ridiculous thing about it. They must have thought I got lucky since the last time I was here.
Yeah. Well, in many ways you have, of course, Sid. You're still there at the moment preparing an article on what, the Clásico? Or maybe the Madrid team that did go top?
Yeah, I must admit, I was really, really tempted to kind of, what's the word, cock a snoop, I think the phrase is, isn't it, at Madrid and Barcelona.
But you didn't have anyone with you, so... Oh, well, sorry, right, go on.
Yeah, but I did eat the cake, though. They left a cake and a carver. I haven't drunk the carver, but I did eat the cake. I was really tempted to write about that, but I thought that, you know, despite everything, this is, you know, the Clásico is still a big story. But it's a fantastic achievement for Atlético Madrid, and I think they're good enough to stay close to the top. I don't think they're going to win the league by any means at all, but I think they're good enough to stay close to the top. And obviously the other thing is, I must confess this, of course I didn't see the Atletico Madrid game either, which is also a little bit of a barrier to writing about it this morning, because it overlapped the Clásico by 10 minutes, and then by the time you've been in the press conferences, been in the mix zone, written stuff up, you've got no chance of seeing it. But Falcao scored one or maybe two, depending on which newspaper you believe, because Marca have decided to give him the own goal.
Now, in the Clásico... Sid, the Clásico, which you did go to and did see, very much billed as a golden boot playoff, this, beyond Real Madrid's desire to make up some of that eight-point deficit they had going into the match. Tell us about it. Was it really as simple as that, Messi against Ronaldo?
No, it wasn't. It wasn't quite as simple as that. But of course, it's very tempting to lean towards that kind of narrative. And indeed, in the match report last night, I did that because, you know, you're right. It was billed not just as a Clásico, but as the kind of the final audition for the Ballon d'Or. That if a player came out of this really head and shoulders above the other one, then that was going to push him a long way towards winning it. It finished, of course, 2-2, two goals each. It's tempting to go back to that analogy that we've used quite a lot in the pod of sometimes you feel like the two of them ring each other up and kind of agree a figure to score that weekend. They've scored the same number of goals as each other in La Liga. They're now level with Falcao or one ahead of Falcao, depending on whether he's been given one or two from last night. The statistics are incredible, by the way. In 2012, between them, they scored exactly 100 goals with their club in this calendar year, which has still got, 2 months to go.
Wow.
And they're just phenomenal. Cristiano Ronaldo, six successive Clásico he scored in last night. That's an all-time record. Messi is now only one goal behind Alfredo Di Stefano's all-time record for Clásico goals. And bear in mind that Di Stefano went on playing till he was 38 when he left Real Madrid. I might be wrong about that. And Messi's 25. It's just astonishing what these two are achieving.
I thought it was quite boring. Is that completely iconoclastic to say that, Sid?
No, I think I wouldn't go so far as to say it was boring because I thought it was exciting. But I think that the brilliance of those two has disguised the fact, for example, if you look at the statistics, 3 shots on target each team. In other words, only 1 shot on target from each team that wasn't a goal. I thought there were relatively few clear chances, only 1 save for each goalkeeper. I thought the passing was pretty imprecise for a lot of the game. I mean, it was very, very exciting, and I really enjoyed it, certainly in the second half when it really started to get going. But I agree. It felt to me like a game that was brilliant in terms of the way it ended and then everything that surrounded it, but perhaps wasn't quite as good as some of the other classicos we've seen.
Yeah, yeah. The narrative of those two trading goals took over from the quality of the sporting cast, and I think for a lot of it.
This is the nature of these two teams, is that the rivalry now has, in terms of the kind of the discourse of the media and stuff, and of course, you know, I and everyone else, I'm complicit in this too. The rivalry sort of gets reduced into these two figures, these two players who define their teams so well in many ways. I mean, both for good and bad, they define their teams stylistically in terms of where they come from, in terms of what they represent and what they symbolise and so on. And by reducing it to them, it does eclipse other really, really good players. But last night actually was one of those occasions when it really was about those two, because as I say, it wasn't a great game. To pick out some good performances, I thought Osil had a poor first half, but a very impressive second half. I thought Sergio Busquets was excellent. Adriano, a left-back playing centre-back, played pretty well. But you just can't look beyond those two players. It's just not possible after a game like that.
Right. Sid?
One important point, because when talking about the Ballon d'Or, the Ballon d'Or will go neither to Messi nor to Ronaldo.
Really?
So, of course not. Oh. The Ballon d'Or doesn't recompense the best player in the world, right. In which case you would say, yeah, it's a straight thing between those two. It goes to the player who's had the greatest calendar year in terms of his achievement, his behaviour on the field, off the field, what he's won, and so forth. So it will go to a member of the Spanish national team.
Or which Chelsea. Is only right. I'm thinking John Terry, perhaps. Huh?
Right, like, can I respond to that?
And it, so basically it's Casillas, Xavi or Iniesta.
Yeah, well, let's respond to that. I think theoretically you're right, but I would change your word "will" and put the word "should" in. Should no, go should, to a player well, from the should,
it's,
national
it's true that
season.
Since FIFA is involved and people who don't know anything.
Well, if
about,
you're talking, I'm well, sorry, no, no, sorry, guys. No, I'm sorry, but if you're talking about a player who's had the most successful 2012, then I'm thinking of a member of the Spanish national team who won the European Championships, who was top scorer in the European Championships, who also won the Champions League final. In Munich, Fernando Torres Ballon d'Or.
Yeah, yeah. For example, but this. But then I think we all know deep down that Fernando Torres is his year wasn't that great. But we come back to this.
Fernando Torres Ballon d'Or would be more the configuration.
Oh,
I think, really.
That's harsh.
Very harsh. But all of this comes back down to something. As Philippe says, the person who wins it will be a Spain player. I think the person who wins it might not be a Spain player.
Ooh.
Maybe should be. Ooh. Maybe should be. But, of course, we're talking about criteria.
Yeah.
In a vote, in a vote that's done by captains, by managers, by journalists, all of whom have different ideas about what they're voting for. They also vote for 3 players each time, so a whole load of second-place votes might be enough to tip someone over the edge. And I think it's one of those years in which there isn't a single individual candidate who absolutely blows everyone else out of the water. Messi's problem, he wasn't at the European Championships. Cristiano Ronaldo's problem, he didn't win the European Championships. The Spanish players' problems that did win the European Championships, well, what else do you hang it on? For example, Iniesta was brilliant at the Euros, but had a slightly up and down sort of year with his club. So I think there isn't an individual outstanding candidate. By the way, if you're going to talk about individual merits, Lionel Messi last year scored more goals than anyone else has ever scored in a football season, ever. So maybe Messi's the first choice, but then Cristiano Ronaldo led Real Madrid to the league, so maybe he's the first choice. I'd be willing to bet that it will not be a Spanish player that wins it.
Oh, that's very, very interesting, Sid. We were going to ask your opinion on Spain-France, but we're not going to now. We're not going to.
My opinion is worth shit. Having just listened to me for 5 minutes, you think, what's the point
Sid
of asking him?
Sid, lean low. How? No, not at all. What it is, we have that fascinating discussion, we kind of ran out of time. So, but there'll be ample chance, because that's not until Tuesday, I'm thinking, is it?
Mm-hmm. That's on Tuesday, yeah.
Yeah, okay, cool. Sid, enjoy your romantic weekend for one. You're having a
It did mean that I got the whole chocolate cake. I didn't have to share it.
There you go. Actually, you know, this kind of thing is called a me date, and it's actually quite an important part of keeping a healthy, healthy balance in your relationship.
Yeah, but my me date involves sitting in front of a laptop. I'm not sure how much of a me date that.
Yeah,
really
I
is.
Think that's actually. I mean, Barry.
Hang on a minute.
Hey, we're going to move on now, listeners. Right, part three then, and in a weekend of footballing excellence, which one got your vote, John Ashdown? Gareth Bale or Luis Suarez?
Both have their merits.
Yeah.
As a connoisseur of the dive, I think I prefer Suarez's effort just because it was more isolated on its own. But Bale, you could say, oh, he was sort of taking evasive action because he thinks he's going to get absolutely hammered by the goalkeeper. But Suarez was a proper, genuine bit of attempted cheating, wasn't it? It was great.
Yeah, you didn't laugh out loud at Gareth Bale the way you did at Luis Suarez.
No, it was hilarious. And he's sort of gone, it helps him sort of to keep him on that kind of super. He is almost like the Uber villain, isn't he? You know, he sort of occasionally you sort of think, oh yeah, he gets a bit hard done by at Norwich of the week, scores a hat-trick, oh maybe he's not so bad after all, and then he throws himself on the floor like that and you just think, oh yeah, remember when he handballed it in the World Cup and ruined it? And
yeah. He should wear a black cape and have a cane and stuff.
Absolutely, yeah. He should basically, like, Spider-Man should fight him.
Cool. Airwaves full of Liverpool fans obviously saying, but what about Stoke? And as if one thing cancels out the other, as if, you know, kind of...
Yeah.
Which it clearly doesn't.
It clearly doesn't. Let's not talk about Stoke, though, because that was a very dull game, the Liverpool-Stoke game. The Bale tumble came in quite an entertaining performance from Spurs, no?
It's all looking much better for ABB all of a sudden, isn't it? Yeah. And, you know... Loris bedded in all right, didn't he? And
well, it's a shame, though, isn't it? It's a shame for Brad Friedel.
It is a shame, after all those games.
I think Hugo Lloris has had a moment, 53rd minute. He's bowling the ball straight to Albrighton, who crosses, and basically there should be a goal. For who misses it? Oh yes, Benteke, who does a typical Bentekean thing and misses it. It would have been 1-0 to the visitors, and it was a terrible thing to do.
What about Paul Lambert and his interesting policy with Darren Bent, who he first took the captaincy off to encourage him to score more goals, then helped him towards his aim by dropping him from the starting lineup, and then this game again, it's Benteke and not Bent.
It does seem an interesting man management policy, doesn't it? You know, he's obviously trying to.
He explains it because of the type of formation that he didn't want to play with two out and out strikers, and therefore prefer to have Benteke and blah blah. And I don't know if it makes complete sense.
All right,
a bit strange. It's as a finisher, there's absolutely no comparison between Benteke and Bent.
Exactly. You think if Bent was on the end of that chance, he would have put it away?
Absolutely, no problem. Just to go back to Lloris, because I might sound a little bit tough on him, right. But first had a very good first half with he showed what he can do, which is he's very quick off his line and he's a great sweeper.
Mm-hmm. Is he articulate?
He is very articulate.
Right, because he's called Lloris, isn't that?
Yes.
Yeah.
Was waiting for this one. And then he had very little to do afterwards. And I must say I was, again, Villas-Boas tried to explain what he had done, and He always adds the sentence that he shouldn't. He should say it, then stop. But he always says one thing he shouldn't say. And he said, Brad Friedel, you know, took it like a man, great professional that he is. Okay, fine. They said, I'm sure he'll be back in the team as soon as possible. And you're thinking, oh, yeah, all right. When is that? For the Europa League game? For the next league game? Are you going to do one of those Lindegaard De Gea sort of thing? No. I mean, where is going? So, more indecision.
It was a strange rationale from the other side as well, wasn't it? He said basically he played Lloris because Lloris played last time and he was going to play in the international break, so he wanted to keep him playing, which didn't, you know, no. Again, didn't seem to quite
I'm confused. Up. Yeah.
But the decision had been taken some time ago because the French staff was aware of the fact that he would be starting the game against Villa at least 24 hours before we heard the first rumours.
But aside from the goalkeeper situation, seems to be bedding in quite nicely for him there now, I think.
Right. Does this mean that a game against Aston Villa is now the equivalent of a fixture in the Capital One Cup or something?
Where you can bed in a new goalkeeper.
Yeah. Right. Interesting. In the meantime, in London football news, big derby over at Upton Park. Some people, I don't know who they were, but some people thought Arsenal might struggle a bit with this game against, you know, old nemesis Big Sam and his exciting, feisty-looking West Ham side, but they didn't struggle, did they, Owen?
They didn't, and Cazorla was absolutely fantastic. I mean, I see...
Santi Gold...
See, Wenger's likened him to Glenn Hoddle today, which is
really?
Yeah, which maybe a little bit early, but I thought that was absolutely fantastic, you know, and kind of along with those Chelsea players we were talking about earlier, it's good to see these players in the Premier League, I mean, you know, carving open defences at will. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
The second half performance by Arsenal was perhaps their best of the season.
Really?
Yeah, no, honestly. And also, it showed, I'm very happy for him, it showed how important Per Mertesacker has become to that team, and everybody was having a good laugh at his expense, you know, saying, oh, he can't turn around, he has got no pace, okay. He's got a few Germany caps, England caps, if only. also, he brings a calmness and a presence to that back line, which is a bit worrying for Laurent Koscielny, I must say, because I can't see how Koscielny is going to get an awful lot of games. And if, you know, when you see the difference, especially at the moment, it's going to take him a while to go back in the team, I believe.
Mm. But they defended pretty woefully against Chelsea, didn't they? And there were a few questions asked after that, and I think they sort of answered those against West Ham.
Right, Giroud getting his first league goal, so that's great for
them. And showing as well that he's first and foremost, he's a very intelligent player, very articulate, to quote you, Jimbo. It's fourth assist of the season, by the way.
Is it?
Yep.
Super duper. Mm-hmm. In other London news, QPR. How about this? They lost this weekend away to West Brom. A lot of people asking how bulletproof is Mark Hughes there, because it was, of course, about this time that they fired the last man. And his record, how about this? His record since his appointment at Loftus Road back in January now reads, played 25, won 6. And they're bottom of the table, John.
Yeah, although we should sort of say there's no shame in, particular shame in losing at West Brom, because everybody that's been to the Hawthorns this season has lost. Mm. But yeah, you get the sense with QPR that there's absolutely no sense of permanence there. Every player seems to be somebody who's there for the short term, and that has kind of, that whole atmosphere has kind of invaded the club, and it just feels like Hughes isn't there for the long term either. I'm always somebody who thinks that you have to give people time, and chopping and changing is inherently a bad thing. But with Cooper at the moment, you just don't get the sense that he's going to be around at the end of the season.
Tony Fernandez once again publicly backing Mark Hughes, but plenty of suggestions that they are actively looking for another manager.
Well, I think there hasn't been any disquiet from the fans as yet. I think that's the thing that might start to tip it. I mean, you know, there's been no vocal chance of Hughes out, because they've seen, you know, the kind of flux that John was talking about, and I think they want to see some stability too. But you're right, I mean, they had that crazy recruitment policy in the summer where they bought all these short-term signings on big money, and if they're not delivering, then you start to wonder what plan B is, you know.
Well, I was going to say, it's quite interesting that some of the pressure that, or some of the calls for Hughes to go have been on Twitter, where Fernandez is a presence on Twitter, which might be a first, I think, in if a manager goes due to Twitter pressure.
Mm. Anything else we want to mention? Everton a little bit hard done by, get a draw, and there was that rather dull game at Anfield, which we kind of mentioned. And City, of course, won against Sunderland. It was a big win, wasn't it? Yes, it was.
Yes, it was. Yes,
yep.
It was.
Yep, good. All right, then, that is it, then, for Football Weekly today. We're back on Thursday with what's bound to be a packed show, given that it is. Looking forward to the big internationals. England-San Marino. Well, I tell you what, that is actually quite an interesting fixture, isn't it? Because it takes you back to Do I Not Like That, and all that whole golden period of kind of Gazza-influenced England hijinks.
Mm. And it is, of course, a chance to see the longest-serving national team manager in the world, Mr. Mazza of San Marino.
Really? How long has he been there?
I think it's 1993. Oof. Check it, guys, but I think it is...
Wow, all right, that was a great angle.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So that brings you back a long time.
But yeah, who France got?
Who France have got? We play Japan.
Japan, to start with,
before we get mullered by Spain.
Well,
at the Calderon.
You never know. You never know, eh? Super. All right. Excellent. Many thanks to John Ashdown, to Owen Gibson, and to Philippe Auclair, as well as producer Ben, who's freshly back from his holes. We're back on Thursday. As you gathered, speak to you then.
Don't forget to get your tickets to the best games in La Liga, Serie A, the Bundesliga, and of course the Premier League. Check out guardiantickets.co.uk/footballweekly.